and special assays. Those quotes weren't from any lengthy report, however. They were from the 2-page summary of Elizabeth and Sonny's meeting with 5 Hopkins officials in April 2010. As it had done with Walgreens, Theranos was again using that meeting to claim that its system had been independently evaluated. But that simply wasn't true. Bill Clark, the director of clinical toxicology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, and one of 3 university scientists who attended the 2010 meeting, had asked Elizabeth to ship one of her devices to his lab so he could put it through its paces and compare its performance to the equipment he normally used. She had indicated she would, but had never followed through. Kate and Mike didn't know any of this, but the fact that Theranos refused to show them the full report made them suspicious. To gain some insights into how to market to doctors, Chiat Day proposed conducting focus group interviews with a few physicians. Theranos signed off on the idea, but wanted to keep things hush-hush, so Kate enlisted her wife and her father to participate in them. Kate's wife, Tracy, was chief resident at Los Angeles County General, where she was completing a residency in internal medicine and pediatrics. During her interview, which was conducted by phone, Tracy asked some questions that no one on the Theranos end of the line seemed able to answer. That evening, she told Kate she was dubious that the company had any truly novel technology. She questioned especially the notion that you could get enough blood from a finger to run tests accurately. Tracy's skepticism gave Kate pause. Kate and Mike's main contacts at Theranos were Christian Holmes and his 2 Duke fraternity brothers, Dan Edlin and Jeff Blickman. Mike called them the Thera Bros. He and Kate talked on the phone and exchanged emails with them frequently in the lead-up to the website launch. Theranos had initially wanted to go live with the site on April 1, 2013, but pushed the date back several times. A new launch date was set for September, but as the new deadline approached and Kate and Mike pressed the Thera Bros for substantiation to back up the claims Elizabeth wanted to make, it became apparent to them that some were exaggerated. For instance, they gleaned that Theranos couldn't produce test results in less than 30 minutes. Kate watered that statement down to say that the results were ready in 4 hours or less, which she still had her doubts about. Kate and Mike also began to suspect that Theranos couldn't perform all its blood tests from small finger stick draws, and that it used traditional venous draws for some tests. They suggested adding a disclaimer to the website to make that clear, but the response they got from Christian and Jeff was that Elizabeth didn't want a disclaimer. Mike was getting worried about Chiat Day's legal liability. He went back and read the agency's contract with Theranos. It indemnified Chiat Day for any claims made in marketing materials that the client had approved in writing. He fired off an email to Joe Sena, an attorney at the agency's outside law firm Davis & Gilbert, asking if Chiat Day should make Theranos use specific language in its written approvals. Sena replied that it wasn't necessary, but urged him to keep track of those written approvals. Kate, meanwhile, was sparring with Christian and Jeff about a line Elizabeth wanted to add to the website that read, "Send samples to us." Kate asked them what logistical system the company had in place to transport the blood samples from physicians' offices to its lab, and eventually concluded it didn't have any. Doctors who registered for the service would merely be generating an automated email routed to Jeff's inbox. What would happen after that was anyone's guess. No one at Theranos had bothered to think it through, as far as Kate could tell. The 48 hours before the website went live turned into a mad scramble. Mike Yagi, who for months had been laboring to write and rewrite copy to Elizabeth's satisfaction and was under a lot of stress, had an anxiety attack and went home to rest. He left the office so abruptly and in such a state that his colleagues didn't know whether he'd ever be coming back. Then, On the evening before the launch, Theranos sent word that it wanted to have an emergency conference call. Kate, Mike, Patrick, Lorraine Ketch, and a copywriter named Christina Altepeter, who was filling in for Yagi, gathered in the warehouse's boardroom, so named because its table was made from surfboards, and listened as Elizabeth announced that Theranos's legal team had ordered last-minute wording changes. Kate and Mike were annoyed. They'd been requesting a legal review for months. Why was it only happening now? The call dragged on for more than 3 hours until 10:30 p.m. They went over the site line by line as Elizabeth slowly dictated every alteration that needed to be made. Patrick nodded off at one point, but Kate and Mike stayed alert enough to notice that the language was being systematically dialed back. "Welcome to a revolution in lab testing" was changed to "Welcome to Theranos." "Faster results, faster answers" became "Fast results, fast answers." "A tiny drop is all it takes" was now "A few drops is all it takes." A blurb of text next to the photo of a blonde-haired, blue-eyed toddler under the headline, "Goodbye, Big Bad Needle," had previously referred only to finger stick draws. Now it read, "Instead of a huge needle, we can use a tiny finger stick or collect a microsample from a venous draw." It wasn't lost on Kate and Mike that this was tantamount to the disclaimer they had previously suggested. In a part of the site titled "Our Lab," a banner running across the page beneath an enlarged photo of a nanotainer had stated, "At Theranos, we can perform all of our lab tests on a sample 1/1000th the size of a typical blood draw." In the new version of the banner, the words "all of" were gone. Lower down on the same page was the claim Kate had pushed back against months earlier. Under the heading "Unrivaled accuracy," it cited the statistic about 93% of lab errors being caused by humans and inferred from it that no other laboratory is more accurate than Theranos. Sure enough, that was walked back too. The last-minute revisions only served to reinforce Kate and Mike's suspicions. Elizabeth had wanted all those sweeping claims to be true, but just because you badly wanted something to be real didn't make it so, Mike thought. He and Kate were beginning to question whether Theranos had any technology at all. Did its vaunted black box, as people at Chiat Day referred to the Theranos device, even exist? They shared their mounting doubts with Stan, whose own interactions with Sonny were becoming increasingly unpleasant. Every quarter, Stan was having to chase Sonny around for money. Sonny kept asking him to justify the bills the agency submitted. Stan spent hours going over them with him point by point. Sonny would put him on speaker and pace around his office. When Stan asked him to move closer to the phone so he could make out what he was saying, Sonny's temper would flare. Not everyone at Chiat Day was souring on Theranos, however. The L.A. office's two higher-ups, Carissa and Patrick, remained smitten with Elizabeth. Patrick idolized Lee Clow and the marketing magic he had conjured up for Apple. It was clear he thought Theranos had the potential to become his own big legacy moment. Kate voiced her concerns to him on several occasions, but he dismissed them as Kate just being Kate. She had a tendency to be overly dramatic, Patrick thought. His view was that she and Mike should stop questioning everything and just complete the work they were being asked to do. In Patrick's experience, all tech startups were chaotic and secretive. He saw nothing unusual or worrisome in that. Chapter 14. Going Live. Alan Beam was sitting in his office reviewing lab reports when Elizabeth poked her head in and asked him to follow her. She wanted to show him something. They stepped outside the lab into an area of open office space where other employees had gathered. At her signal, a technician pricked a volunteer's finger, then applied a transparent plastic implement shaped like a miniature rocket to the blood oozing from it. This was the Theranos sample collection device. Its tip collected the blood and transferred it to two little engines at the rocket's base. The engines weren't really engines. They were nanotainers. To complete the transfer, you pushed the nanotainers into the belly of the plastic rocket like a plunger. The movement created a vacuum that sucked the blood into them. Or at least, that was the idea. But in this instance, things didn't go quite as planned. When the technician pushed the tiny twin tubes into the device, there was a loud pop, and blood splattered everywhere. One of the nanotainers had just exploded. Elizabeth looked unfazed. "Okay, let's try that again," she said calmly. Alan wasn't sure what to make of the scene. He'd only been working at Theranos for a few weeks and was still trying to get his bearings. He knew the nanotainer was part of the company's proprietary blood testing system, but he'd never seen one in action before. He hoped this was just a small mishap that didn't portend bigger problems. The lanky pathologist's circuitous route to Silicon Valley had started in South Africa, where he grew up. After majoring in English at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, WITS to South Africans, he'd moved to the United States to take pre-med classes at Columbia University in New York City. The choice was guided by his conservative Jewish parents, who considered only a few professions acceptable for their son: law, business, and medicine. Alan had stayed in New York for medical school, enrolling at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine on Manhattan's Upper East Side, but he quickly realized that some aspects of being a doctor didn't suit his temperament. Put off by the crazy hours and the sights and smells of the hospital ward, he gravitated toward the more sedate specialty of laboratory science, which led to postdoctoral studies in virology and a residency in clinical pathology at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. In the summer of 2012, Alan was running the lab of a children's hospital in Pittsburgh when he noticed a job posting on LinkedIn that dovetailed perfectly with his budding fascination with Silicon Valley. Laboratory director at a Palo Alto biotech firm. He had just finished reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. The book, which he'd found hugely inspiring, had cemented his desire to move out to the San Francisco Bay Area. After he applied for the job, Alan was asked to fly out for an interview scheduled for 6 p.m. on a Friday. The timing seemed odd, but he was happy to oblige. He met with Sunny first, and then with Elizabeth. There was something about Sunny that he found vaguely creepy, but that impression was more than offset by Elizabeth, who came off as very earnest in her determination to transform healthcare. Like most people who met her for the first time, Alan was taken aback by her deep voice. It was unlike anything he'd heard before. Although he received a job offer just a few days later, Alan wasn't able to start working at Theranos immediately. First, he had to apply for his California medical license. That took 8 months, delaying his official start until April 2013. By then, it had been almost a year since his predecessor, Arnold Gelb, had quit. In between, a semi-retired lab director named Spencer Hiraki had come in occasionally to review and sign off on lab reports. That hadn't seemed too problematic to Alan, since the Theranos lab was only testing a few samples a week from Safeway's employee clinic. What did seem more troubling was the lab's morale when he took it over. Its members were downright despondent. During Alan's first week on the job, Sunny summarily fired one of the CLSs. The poor fellow was frog-marched out by security in front of everyone. Alan got the distinct impression it wasn't the first time something like that had happened. No wonder people's spirits were low, he thought. The lab Alan inherited was divided into two parts: a room on the building's second floor that was filled with commercial diagnostic equipment, and a second room beneath it where research was being conducted. The upstairs room was the CLIA-certified part of the lab, the one Alan was responsible for. Sonny and Elizabeth viewed its conventional machines as dinosaurs that would soon be rendered extinct by Theranos' revolutionary technology, so they called it Jurassic Park. They called the downstairs room Normandy, in reference to the D-Day landings during World War II. The proprietary Theranos devices it contained would take the lab industry by storm, like the Allied troops who braved hails of machine gun fire on Normandy's beaches to liberate Europe from Nazi occupation. In his eagerness and excitement, Alan initially bought into the bravado. But a conversation he had with Paul Patel shortly after the botched nanotainer demonstration raised questions in his mind about how far along the Theranos technology really was. Patel was the biochemist who led the development of blood tests for Theranos' new device, which Alan knew only by its code name, 4S. Patel let slip that his team was still developing its assays on lab plates on the bench. That surprised Alan, who had assumed the assays were already integrated into the 4S. When he asked why that wasn't the case, Patel replied that the new Theranos box wasn't working. By the summer of 2013, as Chiat Day scrambled to ready the Theranos website for the company's commercial launch, the 4S, aka the Mini Lab, had been under development for more than 2.5 years. But the device remained very much a work in progress. The list of its problems was lengthy. The biggest problem of all was the dysfunctional corporate culture in which it was being developed. Elizabeth and Sonny regarded anyone who raised a concern or an objection as a cynic and a naysayer. Employees who persisted in doing so were usually marginalized or fired, while sycophants were promoted. Sonny had elevated a group of ingratiating Indians to key positions. One of them was Sam Anakal, the manager in charge of integrating the various components of the mini-lab who had clashed with Ian Gibbons. Another was Chinmay Pangarkar, a bioengineer with a PhD in chemical engineering from the University of California, Santa Barbara. There was also Suraj Saxena, a clinical chemist who had a PhD in biochemistry and biophysics from Texas A&M. On paper, all three had impressive educational credentials, but they shared two traits. They had very little industry experience, having joined the company not long after finishing their studies, and they had a habit of telling Elizabeth and Sonny what they wanted to hear, either out of fear or out of desire to advance, or both. For the dozens of Indians Theranos employed, the fear of being fired was more than just the dread of losing a paycheck. Most were on H-1B visas and dependent on their continued employment at the company to remain in the country. With a despotic boss like Sonny holding their fates in his hands, it was akin to indentured servitude. Sonny, in fact, had the master-servant mentality common among an older generation of Indian businessmen. Employees were his minions. He expected them to be at his disposal at all hours of the day or night and on weekends. He checked the security logs every morning to see when they badged in and out. Every evening, around 7:30, he made a flyby of the engineering department to make sure people were still at their desks working. With time, some employees grew less afraid of him and devised ways to manage him, as it dawned on them that they were dealing with an erratic man-child of limited intellect and an even more limited attention span. Arnav Khanna, a young mechanical engineer who worked on the mini-lab, figured out a surefire way to get Sonny off his back. Answer his emails with a reply longer than 500 words. That usually bought him several weeks of peace because Sonny simply didn't have the patience to read long emails. Another strategy was to convene a biweekly meeting of his team and invite Sonny to attend. He might come to the first few, but he would eventually lose interest or forget to show up. While Elizabeth was fast to catch on to engineering concepts, Sonny was often out of his depth during engineering discussions. To hide it, he had a habit of repeating technical terms he heard others using. During a meeting with Arnov's team, he latched on to the term end effector, which signifies the claws at the end of a robotic arm. Except Sonny didn't hear end effector, he heard endofactor. For the rest of the meeting, he kept referring to the fictional endofactors. At their next meeting with Sonny 2 weeks later, Arnov's team brought a PowerPoint presentation titled Endofactors Update. As Arnov flashed it on a screen with a projector, the five members of his team stole furtive glances at one another, nervous that Sonny might become wise to the prank. But he didn't bat an eye, and the meeting proceeded without incident. After he left the room, they burst out laughing. Arnov and his team also got Sonny to use the obscure engineering term crazing. It normally refers to a phenomenon that produces fine cracks on the surface of a material, but Arnov and his colleagues used it liberally and out of context to see if they could get Sonny to repeat it, which he did. Sonny's knowledge of chemistry was no better. He thought the chemical symbol for potassium was P. It's K. P is the symbol for phosphorus, a mistake most high school chemistry students wouldn't make. Not all the setbacks encountered during the Minilab's development could be laid at Sonny's feet, however. Some were a consequence of Elizabeth's unreasonable demands. For instance, she insisted that the Minilab cartridges remain a certain size, but kept wanting to add more assays to them. Arnov didn't see why the cartridges couldn't grow by half an inch, since consumers wouldn't see them. After her run-in with Lieutenant Colonel David Shoemaker, Elizabeth had abandoned her plan of putting the Theranos devices in Walgreens stores and operating them remotely to avoid problems with the FDA. Instead, blood pricked from patients' fingers would be couriered to Theranos's Palo Alto lab and tested there. But she remained stuck on the notion that the Minilab was a consumer device, like an iPhone or an iPad, and that its components needed to look small and pretty. She still nurtured the ambition of putting it in people's homes someday, as she had promised early investors. Another difficulty stemmed from Elizabeth's insistence that the Minilab be capable of performing the four major classes of blood tests: immunoassays, general chemistry assays, hematology assays, and assays that relied on the amplification of DNA. The only known approach that would permit combining all of them in one desktop machine was to use robots wielding pipettes. But this approach had an inherent flaw. Over time, a pipette's accuracy drifts. When the pipette is brand new, aspirating 5 microliters of blood might require the little motor that activates the pipette's pump to rotate by a certain amount. But 3 months later, that exact same rotation of the motor might yield only 4.4 microliters of blood, a large enough difference to throw off the entire assay. While pipette drift was something that ailed all blood analyzers that relied on pipetting systems, the phenomenon was particularly pronounced on the Minilab. Its pipettes had to be recalibrated every 2 to 3 months, and the recalibration process put the device out of commission for 5 days. Kyle Logan, a young chemical engineer who joined Theranos right out of Stanford after earning an academic award there named after Channing Robertson, had frequent debates with Sam Anacall about this issue. He thought the company should migrate to a more reliable system that didn't involve pipettes, such as the one Abaxis used in its Piccolo Express analyzer. Sam would reply that the Piccolo could perform only one class of blood test, general chemistry assays. Unlike immunoassays, which measure a substance in the blood by using antibodies that bind to the substance, general chemistry assays rely on other chemical principles such as light absorbance or electrical signal changes. Elizabeth wanted a machine that was more versatile, he'd remind Kyle. Compared to big commercial blood analyzers, another one of the Minilab's glaring weaknesses was that it could process only one blood sample at a time. Commercial machines were bulky for a reason. They were designed to process hundreds of samples simultaneously. In industry jargon, this was known as having a high throughput. If the Theranos wellness centers attracted a lot of patients, the mini lab's low throughput would result in long wait times and make a joke of the company's promise of fast test results. In an attempt to remedy this problem, someone had come up with the idea of stacking 6 mini labs one on top of the other and having them share one cytometer to reduce the size and cost of the resulting contraption. This Frankenstein machine was called the six-blade, a term borrowed from the computer industry, where stacking servers on top of one another is common to save space and energy. In these modular stacking configurations, each server is referred to as a blade. But no one had stopped to consider what implications this design would have with respect to one key variable: temperature. Each mini-lab blade generated heat, and heat rises. When the 6 blades were processing samples at the same time, the temperature in the top blades reached a level that interfered with their assays. Kyle, who was 22 and just out of college, couldn't believe something that basic had been overlooked. Aside from its cartridge, pipette, and temperature issues, many of the other technical snafus that plagued the mini lab could be chalked up to the fact that it remained at a very early prototype stage. Less than 3 years was not a lot of time to design and perfect a complex medical device. These problems ranged from the robot's arms landing in the wrong places, causing pipettes to break, to the spectrophotometers being badly misaligned. At one point, the blood-spinning centrifuge in one of the mini-labs blew up. These were all things that could be fixed, but it would take time. The company was still several years away from having a viable product that could be used on patients. However, as Elizabeth saw it, she didn't have several years. 12 months earlier, on June 5, 2012, she'd signed a new contract with Walgreens that committed Theranos to launching its blood testing services in some of the pharmacy chain's stores by February 1, 2013, in exchange for a $100 million innovation fee and an additional $40 million loan. Theranos had missed that deadline, another postponement in what, from Walgreens' perspective, had been 3 years of delays. With Steve Bird's retirement, the Safeway partnership was already falling apart, and if she waited much longer, Elizabeth risked losing Walgreens too. She was determined to launch in Walgreens stores by September, come hell or high water. Since the mini lab was in no state to be deployed, Elizabeth and Sonny decided to dust off the Edison and launch with the older device. That, in turn, led to another fateful decision, the decision to cheat. In June, Daniel Young, the brainy MIT PhD who headed Theranos' biomath team, came to see Alan Beam in Jurassic Park with a subordinate named Jinwei Gong in tow. In the 5 years since he'd joined Theranos, Daniel had risen up the ranks to become the company's de facto number 3 executive. He had Elizabeth and Sonny's ear, and they often deferred to him to solve nettlesome technical problems. In his first few years at Theranos, Daniel had seemed every bit the family man, leaving the office at 6 every evening to have dinner with his wife and kids. This routine had drawn snickers behind his back from some colleagues. But after being promoted to vice president, Daniel had become a different person. He worked longer hours and stayed at the office later. He got very drunk at company parties, which was jarring because he was always quiet and inscrutable at work. And there were whispers of a flirtation with a coworker. Daniel told Alan that he and Gong, who went by Sam, were going to tinker with the Advia 1800, one of the lab's commercial analyzers. The Advia was a hulking 1,320-pound machine the size of 2 large office copiers put together that was made by Siemens Healthcare, the German conglomerate's medical product subsidiary. Over the next few weeks, Alan observed Sam spend hours opening the machine up and filming its innards with his iPhone camera. He was hacking into it to try to make it compatible with small finger stick blood samples, Alan realized. It seemed like confirmation of what Paul Patel had told him. The 4S must not be working. Otherwise, why resort to such desperate measures? Alan knew the Edison could only perform immunoassays, so it made sense that Daniel and Sam would choose the Advia, which specialized in general chemistry assays. One of the panels of blood tests most commonly ordered by physicians was known as the Chem-18 panel. Its components, which ranged from tests to measure electrolytes, such as sodium, potassium, and chloride, to tests used to monitor patients' kidney and liver functions, were all general chemistry assays. Launching in Walgreens stores with a menu of blood tests that didn't include these tests would have been pointless. They accounted for about 2/3 of doctors' orders. But the Advia was designed to handle a larger quantity of blood than you could obtain by pricking a finger. So Daniel and Sam thought up a series of steps to adapt the Siemens analyzer to smaller samples. Chief among these was the use of a big robotic liquid handler called the T-can to dilute the little blood samples collected in the nanotainers with a saline solution. Another was to transfer the diluted blood into custom-designed cups half the size of the ones that normally went into the Advia. The combination of these two steps solved a problem known as dead volume. Like many commercial analyzers, the Advia featured a probe that dropped down into the blood sample and aspirated it. Although it aspirated most of the sample, there was always some unused liquid left at the bottom. Reducing the sample cup's size brought its bottom closer to the probe's tip, and diluting the blood created more liquid to work with. Alan had reservations about the dilution part. The Siemens analyzer already diluted blood samples when it performed its assays. The protocol Daniel and Sam had come up with meant that the blood would be diluted twice, once before it went into the machine and a second time inside it. Any lab director worth his salt knew that the more you tampered with a blood sample, the more room you introduced for error. Moreover, this double dilution lowered the concentration of the analytes in the blood samples to levels that were below the Advia's FDA-sanctioned analytic measurement range. In other words, it meant using the machine in a way that neither the manufacturer nor its regulator approved of. To get the final patient result, one had to multiply the diluted result by the same factor the blood had been diluted by, not knowing whether the diluted result was even reliable. Daniel and Sam were nonetheless proud of what they'd accomplished. At heart, both were engineers for whom patient care was an abstract concept. If their tinkering turned out to have adverse consequences, they weren't the ones who would be held personally responsible. It was Alan's name, not theirs, that was on the CLIA certificate. When their work was finished, a Theranos lawyer named Jim Fox came by Alan's office and suggested the company patent what they had done. That seemed to Alan like a ridiculous idea. To his mind, fiddling with another manufacturer's device didn't amount to inventing something new, especially if it no longer worked as well afterward. Word that the Siemens machines had been jailbroken made its way to Ted Pasco, who had succeeded John Fonzio as procurement manager and in the process inherited his role as the prime recipient of company gossip. Ted soon got confirmation of what he'd heard through the rumor mill when he received instructions from Elizabeth and Sonny to purchase 6 more Advias. He negotiated a bulk discount with Siemens, but the order still cost well north of $100,000. As September 9, 2013 approached, the date Elizabeth had set for the launch, Alan grew worried that Theranos wasn't ready. 2 of the assays performed on the hacked Siemens analyzers were giving the lab particular trouble, sodium and potassium. Allen suspected the cause of the latter was a phenomenon known as hemolysis, which occurs when red blood cells burst and release extra potassium into the sample. Hemolysis was a known side effect of finger stick collection. Milking blood from a finger puts stress on red blood cells and could cause them to break apart. Allen had noticed a piece of paper with a number on it taped to Elizabeth's office window. It was her launch countdown. The sight of it made him panic. A few days before the launch, he went to see her and asked her to delay. Elizabeth wasn't her usual confident self. Her voice was tremulous, and she was visibly shaking as she tried to reassure him that everything would be okay. If necessary, they could fall back on regular venous draws, she told him. That briefly made Allen feel better, but his anxiety returned as soon as he left her office. Anjali Lagari, the chemist who had worked with Ian Gibbons for a total of 10 years at Theranos and another biotech company, was dismayed when she returned from her 3-week vacation in India in late August. Anjali headed the immunoassay group. Her team had been trying for years to develop blood tests on Theranos' older device, the Edison. Much to her frustration, the black and white machine's error rate was still high for some tests. Elizabeth and Sonny had been promising her for a year that all would be well once the company introduced its next-generation device, the 4S. Except that day never seemed to arrive. That was fine as long as Theranos remained a research and development operation, which was still the case when Anjali had departed for India 3 weeks earlier. But now everyone was suddenly talking about going live, and there were emails in her inbox referring to an imminent commercial launch. Launch? With what? Anjali wondered with growing alarm. In her absence, she learned, employees who were not authorized CLIA lab personnel had been let into the lab. She didn't know why, but she did know the lab was under instructions to conceal whatever it was they were doing from Siemens representatives when they came by to service the German manufacturer's machines. Changes had also been made to the way samples were being processed on the Edisons. Under Sonny's orders, they were now being pre-diluted with a T-can liquid handler before being run through the device. This was to make up for the fact that the Edison could run at most 3 tests on 1 fingerstick sample. Pre-diluting the blood created more volume to run more tests. But if the device already had a high error rate under normal circumstances, an additional dilution step seemed likely only to make things worse. Anjali also had concerns about the nanotainers. Blood would dry up in the little tubes, and she and her colleagues often couldn't extract enough from them. She tried to talk sense into Elizabeth and Daniel Young by emailing them Edison data from Theranos' last study with a pharmaceutical company, Celgene, which dated back to 2010. In that study, Theranos had used the Edison to track inflammatory markers in the blood of patients who had asthma. The data had shown an unacceptably high error rate, causing Celgene to end the company's collaboration. Nothing had changed since that failed study, Anjali reminded them. Neither Elizabeth nor Daniel acknowledged her email. After 8 years at the company, Anjali felt she was at an ethical crossroads. To still be working out the kinks in the product was one thing when you were in R&D mode and testing blood volunteered by employees and their family members, but going live in Walgreens stores meant exposing the general population to what was essentially a big unauthorized research experiment. That was something she couldn't live with. She decided to resign. When Elizabeth heard the news, she asked Anjali to come by her office. She wanted to know why she was leaving and whether she could be persuaded to stay. Anjali repeated her concerns. The Edison's error rate was too high, and the nanotainer still had problems. Why not wait until the 4S was ready? Why rush to launch now? She asked. Because when I promise something to a customer, I deliver, Elizabeth replied. That response made no sense to Anjali. Walgreens was just a business partner. Theranos' ultimate customers would be the patients who came to Walgreens stores and ordered its blood tests, thinking they could rely on them to make medical decisions. Those were the customers Elizabeth should be worrying about. By the time Anjali got back to her desk, word of her resignation had spread, and co-workers were coming up to her to say goodbye. She had given 1 week's notice and was planning to work until the end of her notice period, but Sunny didn't like the scene these public farewells were causing. He sent Mona Ramamurthy, the head of human resources, to tell her that she had to leave immediately. On her way out, Anjali printed the email she had sent to Elizabeth and Daniel. She had a feeling this wasn't going to end well, and she needed something to protect herself, something that would show she had disagreed with the decision to launch. Forwarding the email to her personal Yahoo account would have been easier, but she knew Sunny closely monitored employees' email activity. So she hid the printout in her bag and smuggled it out. Anjali wasn't the only one with misgivings. Tina Noyes, her deputy in the immunoassay group, who had worked at Theranos for more than 7 years, also quit. The resignations infuriated Elizabeth and Sunny. The following day, they summoned the staff for an all-hands meeting in the cafeteria. Copies of The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho's famous novel about an Andalusian shepherd boy who finds his destiny by going on a journey to Egypt, had been placed on every chair. Still visibly angry, Elizabeth told the gathered employees that she was building a religion. If there were any among them who didn't believe, they should leave. Sunny put it more bluntly. Anyone not prepared to show complete devotion and unmitigated loyalty to the company should get the fuck out. Chapter 15. Unicorn. She hated the artist's illustration. He had made her head huge and given her a vacuous, doe-eyed grin that screamed blonde bimbo. Other than that, there wasn't much to dislike about the article. It took up most of a page in the front section of the Wall Street Journal and hit all the right notes. Drawing blood the traditional way with a needle in the arm was likened to vampirism, or as the writer put it more elegantly, medicine by Bram Stoker. Theranos' processes, by contrast, were described as requiring only microscopic blood volumes, and as faster, cheaper, and more accurate than the conventional methods. The brilliant young Stanford dropout behind the breakthrough invention was anointed the next Steve Jobs or Bill Gates by no less than former Secretary of State George Shultz, the man many credited with winning the Cold War, in a quote at the end of the article. Elizabeth had engineered the piece, which was published in the Saturday, September 7, 2013 edition of the journal, to coincide with the commercial launch of Theranos' blood testing services. A press release was due to go out first thing Monday morning, announcing the opening of the first Theranos Wellness Center in a Walgreens store in Palo Alto, and plans for a subsequent nationwide expansion of the partnership. For a heretofore unknown startup, coverage this flattering in one of the country's most prominent and respected publications was a major coup. What had made it possible was Elizabeth's close relationship with Shultz, a connection she'd made 2 years earlier and carefully cultivated. The former statesman, who in addition to crafting the Reagan administration's foreign policy, also served as Secretary of Labor and Secretary of the Treasury under President Nixon, had joined the Theranos Board of Directors in July 2011 and become one of Elizabeth's biggest champions. A distinguished fellow at the Hoover Institution, the think tank housed on the Stanford campus, Shultz remained a revered and influential figure in Republican circles despite his advancing age. He was 92. That made him a friend of the journal's famously conservative editorial page, to which he occasionally contributed op-eds. During a visit to the paper's Midtown Manhattan headquarters to discuss climate change with its editorial board in 2012, Schultz had dropped mention of a secretive and reclusive Silicon Valley startup founder who he felt certain was going to revolutionize medicine with her technology. Intrigued, the journal's long-serving editorial page editor, Paul Gigot, had offered to send one of his writers to interview the mysterious wunderkind when she felt ready to break her silence and introduce her invention to the world. A year later, Schultz had called back with word that Elizabeth was ready, and Gigot had handed the assignment to Joseph Rago, a member of the journal's editorial board who had written extensively about healthcare. The resulting piece ran in the Weekend Interview column, a fixture of the Saturday Journal's opinion pages. Elizabeth had picked a safe place for her coming out party. The Weekend Interview, which rotated among the members of Gigot's staff, wasn't meant to be hard-hitting investigative journalism. Rather, it was what its name implied, an interview whose tone was usually friendly and non-confrontational. Moreover, her message of bringing disruption to an old and inefficient industry was bound to play well with the journal editorial page's pro-business, anti-regulation ethos. Nor did Rago, who had won a Pulitzer Prize for tough editorials dissecting Obamacare, have any reason to suspect that what Elizabeth was telling him wasn't true. During his visit to Palo Alto, she had shown him the Minilab and the Six-Blade side by side, and he had volunteered for a demonstration, receiving what appeared to be accurate lab results in his email inbox before he even left the building. What he didn't know was that Elizabeth was planning to use the Walgreens launch and his accompanying article containing her misleading claims as the public validation she needed to kickstart a new fundraising campaign, one that would propel Theranos to the forefront of the Silicon Valley stage. Mike Barsanti was vacationing in Lake Tahoe when he received a call on his cell phone from Donald A. Lucas, the son of legendary venture capitalist Donald L. Lucas. Mike and Don had gone to college together in the early 1980s at Santa Clara University and had remained friendly ever since. Mike was the retired chief financial officer of a Bay Area seafood and poultry business that his family had operated for more than six decades before selling it the previous year. Don was calling to pitch Mike on an investment, Theranos. That came as a surprise to Mike. He had last heard of the startup 7 years earlier when he and Don had attended a 20-minute presentation Elizabeth gave on Sand Hill Road, showcasing her little blood testing machine. Mike remembered Elizabeth very well. She'd come off as a dowdy young scientist back then, wearing Coke bottle glasses and no makeup, speaking nervously to an audience of men 2 to 3 times her age. At the time, Don ran RWI Ventures, a firm he'd founded in the mid-1990s after spending 10 years learning the ropes of the venture capital business working for his father. Mike had been an investor in RWI. His curiosity piqued by the awkward but obviously smart young woman, he'd asked Don why the firm wasn't taking a flyer on her like his father had. Don had replied that after careful consideration, he'd decided against it. Elizabeth was all over the place. She wasn't focused. His father couldn't control her, even though he chaired her board, and Don didn't like or trust her, Mike recalled his friend telling him. Don, what's changed? Mike now asked. Don explained excitedly that Theranos had come a long way since then. The company was about to announce the launch of its innovative finger stick tests in one of the country's largest retail chains. And that wasn't all, he said. The Theranos devices were also being used by the U.S. military. Did you know they're in the back of Humvees in Iraq? He asked Mike. Mike wasn't sure he'd heard right. What? He blurted out. Yeah, I saw them stacked up at Theranos' headquarters after they came back. If all this was true, these were impressive developments, Mike thought. Don had launched a new firm in 2009 called the Lucas Venture Group. In recognition of her long-standing relationship with his aging father, who was addled by the onset of Alzheimer's disease, Elizabeth was giving him the chance to invest in the company at a discount to the price other investors were going to be offered in a big forthcoming fundraising round. Intent on seizing what he saw as a great opportunity, the Lucas Venture Group was raising money for two new funds, Don told Mike. One of them was a traditional venture fund that would invest in several companies, including Theranos. The second would be exclusively devoted to Theranos. Did Mike want in? If so, time was short. The transaction had to close by the end of September. A few weeks later, on the afternoon of September 9, 2013, Mike received an email from Don with the subject line, Theranos, time sensitive, that contained more details. The email, which went out to people who, like Mike, had previously invested in Don's funds, provided links to the Wall Street Journal article and to the Theranos press release from that morning. The Lucas Venture Group, it said, had been invited to invest up to $15 million in Theranos. The discounted price Elizabeth was offering the firm valued the company at $6 billion. Mike took a deep breath. That was a huge valuation. He couldn't help but be annoyed with Don. When his friend had brushed aside his suggestion that they invest 7 years before, Theranos had been valued around $40 million, he remembered ruefully. Granted, the company seemed like a much surer bet now. Don's email said Theranos had signed contracts and partnerships with very large retailers and drug stores, as well as various pharmaceutical companies, HMOs, insurance agencies, hospitals, clinics, and various government agencies. It also said the company had been cash flow positive since 2006. Mike and 10 of his family members had pooled their money together in a limited liability company so they could invest in these types of venture deals. After conferring with them, he decided to pull the trigger on the investment and sent Don $790,000. Dozens of other Lucas Venture Group investors, known in industry parlance as limited partners, did the same, cutting checks of varying amounts. They ranged from Robert Coleman, a co-founder of the defunct San Francisco investment bank Robertson Stevens and Company, to a retired Palo Alto psychotherapist. By the fall of 2013, money was flowing into the Valley ecosystem at such a dizzying pace that a new term was coined to describe the new breed of startups it was spawning. In an article published on the technology news website TechCrunch on November 2, 2013, a venture capitalist named Aileen Lee wrote about the proliferation of startups valued at $1 billion or more. She called them unicorns. Despite their moniker, these tech unicorns were no myth. By Lee's count, there were 39 of them, a number that would soon soar past 100. Instead of rushing to the stock market like their dot-com predecessors had in the late 1990s, the unicorns were able to raise staggering amounts of money privately and thus avoid the close scrutiny that came with going public. The poster child of the unicorns was Uber, the ride-hailing smartphone app co-founded by the hard-charging engineer Travis Kalanick. A few weeks before Elizabeth's journal interview, Uber had raised $361 million at a valuation of $3.5 billion. There was also Spotify, the music streaming service that in November 2013 raised $250 million at a price per share that valued the whole company at $4 billion. These companies' valuations would keep rising over the next few years, but for now, they had been leapfrogged by Theranos, and the gap was about to get bigger. The journal article caught the attention of Christopher James and Brian Grossman, two seasoned investment professionals who ran a hedge fund based in San Francisco called Partner Fund Management. With about $4 billion in assets, Partner Fund had a successful track record, having notched up average annual returns of nearly 10% since James had founded it in 2004. Part of that success could be credited to its large healthcare portfolio, which was overseen by Grossman. After they reached out to her, Elizabeth invited James and Grossman over for a meeting on December 15, 2013. When they arrived at Theranos' headquarters, a sprawling beige structure built into the side of a hill a stone's throw from the Stanford campus, the first thing they both noticed was the heavy security. There were multiple guards at the entrance, and they had to sign non-disclosure agreements just to be allowed into the building. Once inside, guards escorted them everywhere, even to the bathroom. Parts of the building couldn't be accessed without special key cards and were off-limits to them. Elizabeth and Sonny had always been security conscious, but their level of paranoia had reached a new peak with the launch in Walgreens stores. They had convinced themselves that Quest and LabCorp viewed Theranos as a mortal threat to their cozy oligopoly and that they would try to quash their new competitor by any means available. There was also the matter of the promise John Fuse had made in his deposition to fuck with Elizabeth until she died. She took that threat very seriously. Following his retirement from the military earlier that year, James Mattis had joined the Theranos board, and, on his recommendation, Elizabeth had hired Jim Rivera, the head of his Pentagon security detail. Rivera was a grizzled pro who had protected Mattis during his frequent trips to Iraq and Afghanistan. He wore a gun holstered under his jacket or around his ankle at all times, and led a team of a half dozen guards who were dressed in black suits and wore earpieces. The tight security measures made an impression on James and Grossman. It called to mind the lengths to which the Coca-Cola company went to guard its secret Coke formula, and suggested to them that Theranos had very valuable intellectual property to protect. The representations Elizabeth and Sonny made to them cemented that belief. During that first meeting, Elizabeth and Sonny told their guests that Theranos's proprietary fingerstick technology could perform blood tests covering 1,000 of the 1,300 codes laboratories used to bill Medicare and private health insurers, according to a lawsuit Partner Fund later filed against the company. Many blood tests involve several billing codes, so the actual number of tests represented by those 1,000 codes was in the low hundreds. At a second meeting 3 weeks later, they showed them a PowerPoint presentation containing scatter plots purporting to compare test data from Theranos' proprietary analyzers to data from conventional lab machines. Each plot showed data points tightly clustered around a straight line that rose up diagonally from the horizontal x-axis. This indicated that Theranos' test results were almost perfectly correlated with those of the conventional machines. In other words, its technology was as accurate as traditional testing. The rub was that much of the data in the charts wasn't from the mini-lab or even from the Edison. It was from other commercial blood analyzers Theranos had purchased, including one manufactured by a company located an hour north of Palo Alto called Biorad. Sonny also told James and Grossman that Theranos had developed about 300 different blood tests, ranging from commonly ordered tests to measure glucose, electrolytes, and kidney function, to more esoteric cancer detection tests. He boasted that Theranos could perform 98% of them on tiny blood samples pricked from a finger, and that, within 6 months, it would be able to do all of them that way. These 300 tests represented 99 to 99.9% of all laboratory requests, and Theranos had submitted every single one of them to the FDA for approval, he said. Sonny and Elizabeth's boldest claim was that the Theranos system was capable of running 70 different blood tests simultaneously on a single fingerstick sample, and that it would soon be able to run even more. The ability to perform so many tests on just a drop or two of blood was something of a holy grail in the field of microfluidics. Thousands of researchers around the world in universities and industry had been pursuing this goal for more than 2 decades, Ever since the Swiss scientist Andreas Mons had shown that the microfabrication techniques developed by the computer chip industry could be repurposed to make small channels that moved tiny volumes of fluids. But it had remained beyond reach for a few basic reasons. The main one was that different classes of blood tests required vastly different methods.